for all things to be made new, a.k.a. the lion lays with the lamb. You see what's happening? This is what they're expecting. Therefore, you can see how all of this makes sense in one question. It's not that they're stupid. It's that they have a Jewish lens that they are interpreting everything by. And Jesus is redefining the lens. Then, not to mention the fact that it's not just theology that drives their question, but it's location. Because Zechariah chapter 14, verses 1 through 5, talks about this inauguration of the golden age. Zechariah 14, 1 through 5, this golden age is coming. And what happened in Zechariah 14 is that God calls all the nations of the world to the foot of a mountain, and then He fights those nations for the nation of Israel. And guess what mountain He gathers all them together? The Mount of Olives. Where are they at? Mount of Olives. You see what's happening for them? It's not just the Messiah talk that's getting them all excited. It's their location in the area in which He is saying this stuff. The location is informing their interpretation, which is betrayed in their question. Their question sees the destruction of the temple and the second coming as the same thing, because that's the definition in their minds of the golden age. And Jesus says, no. You're conflating two events that are actually, or that you're into one that are actually two. Does that make sense? You see where we're going here? Okay, let's go ahead and keep reading. Verse 4. Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you." That is the mission statement for the first 35 verses. Watch out that no one deceives you. Okay, at this point people will say, now Jesus is now talking about the second coming. He has jumped to the end, and the rest of the time it's all about the second coming. And I have a couple of problems with that. Number one, context militates against that. Because Jesus in verse 38 of chapter 23 has been talking about what? Destruction of the temple. Then He makes a prediction in verse 2 of chapter 24, which is talking about what? Destruction of the temple. Even the question in verse 3 of the disciples is talking about the destruction of the temple. They've just misdefined it. So to say at this point that Jesus all of a sudden jumps to the second coming is unfounded contextually. Not to mention the fact that throughout the first 35 verses, guess what's one of the most popular words that Jesus uses? You. Second person personal pronoun. You. And who is the you in context? The disciples asking the question. So He says here in verse 4, watch out that no one deceives you. Who is He talking about? The disciples that are asking the question about the destruction of a temple. This is actually a guy that, his name's Gleason Archer, and he actually is a futurist. But he, in this, I'm going to read this to you, he actually, though, points out that the idiocy of talking about the word you as referring to a future generation simply doesn't make sense. He says, how can we possibly imagine that when Christ said to His disciples, these are the signs you are to look for, He really meant, you will never see these signs at all, but 1900 years from now, some distant descendants of yours are to look for these signs. And then He goes on, He says, yet if He addressed His remarks to non-existent people who would not even be born until 19 centuries later, then His Olivet Discourse boils down to this. In other words, all of Matthew 24 then would mean this, if it has nothing to do with the disciples. He says, Matthew 24 would say then, here are the signs you are to look for, but when I say you, I don't mean you, but a future generation about almost 2,000 years in the future. And when I say, look for these signs, you are not to look for them because you will not survive long enough even to see them. And He says, this kind of interpretation adds up to a serious violation of the perspicuity of Scripture or the intelligibleness of what we're reading. You see what His argument is, even though it militates against His position. His argument is that if you does not belong to the disciples, if He's not talking to the disciples, then this makes absolutely no sense. Matter of fact, in verse 9, He's going to say, then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of Me. Either that's a 2,000 years from now you, or it's an actual you that has asked the question that He's speaking to. You see what I'm arguing? My arguing is this. When verse 4 starts, He's still talking about the destruction of the temple that the disciples, or the you, would have experienced in their lifetime. And they did experience it in their lifetime. In A.D. 70. Let's keep going. Verse 5. For many will come in My name, claiming I am the Christ, and will deceive many. This actually happened. There were many false Christs. There were many false prophets. that came in His name. As a matter of fact, whenever you guys get your handouts, I have a whole list, a whole chart in the back of your handout that lists a lot of the false Christs and a lot of the false prophets that were going around saying, I am the Messiah during the time of AD 66 and 70. And there, the list is actually modest because it's based off of what we just have textually. We didn't mark down all the ones that were word of mouth because we didn't have evidence of that. However, Jerome, a writer in the first century, says this about AD 70. He says, at the time of the Jewish captivity by Rome, many Jewish elders claimed to be the Christ. Did you hear that? There were so many, in fact, Jerome says, that there were three distinct camps of them when the Romans besieged Jerusalem. Jerome, one of the early Christian fathers, says there were so many people claiming to be the Christ whenever Jerusalem was about ready to fall that when Rome came to besiege the city, there was actually three different camps in the city itself that were claiming we have the Messiah. You see what's happening? That whenever Jesus talked about these signs, guess what? We see the signs in history. Okay? And guess what they point to? The destruction of the temple. Keep reading. Verse 6. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Now, we've heard that passage before, right? But here's the problem. What is the first word of that sentence? You. And who is the you? The disciples. You, disciples, will hear of wars and rumors of wars. But see to it that you are not alarmed. Remember, that's his whole point. I don't want you to be caught off guard. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Were there wars and rumors of wars? Oh, yeah. 39 Caligula, the crazy Caligula, was going to take a statue of himself and put it up in the temple. And Josephus says, if it would have happened, the temple would have been destroyed in 39. But somehow Caligula dies, and then the war never happened. There were wars and rumors of wars. As a matter of fact, Claudius, who reigned from 41... right after Caligula, all the way up to 54, there was all kinds of stuff about unrest and wars that were going to happen that were going to be cataclysmic for the Roman Empire. They never came to fruition. 54 all the way up to 68, Nero, which obviously you see 68 leads us right up to the footsteps of AD 70, there were wars and rumors of wars all over then too. This is documented. Is what Jesus saying pointing to a future time, or did it happen right around AD 70? Guess what? We can point to history and say, no, he's right. There were wars and rumors of wars that you, disciples, would have experienced. Keep reading, verse 7. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. I want to look at those two elements, famines and earthquakes. We have documented evidence that there were around 17 different earthquakes at the time in the first century in Palestine. As a matter of fact, we have evidence that AD 60 in Asia Minor, where Laodicea, one of the seven cities of Revelation, was totally wiped out by an earthquake, which also destroyed Colossae. There were earthquakes all over the place in this region during the first century. And earthquakes were commonly associated then, not so much now, although I don't know what's changed, as a judgment of God. Famines. I don't know if you've read in Paul's epistles, but like in Romans, he talks about going, and even in 1 Corinthians 16, he talks about going from church to church and collecting from the Christian churches an offering. And what's the offering for? Do you remember? It's for the church in Jerusalem that's going through a famine. This is in Paul's letters that were written around the 50s and in early 60s. Not to mention the fact, and this is something that you will have in your notes when you get them, but I'll describe to you now. Josephus describes this picture, and I'm describing this not for the sense of being gross, but for the sense of trying to let you know what was going on around AD 66 to 70 when the temple was being destroyed. Josephus describes this mother in Jerusalem at the time in which the war is going on. Because the war didn't just start in AD 70, it started in 66 and lasted for 4 years. Some people even stretch out to 73, the pinnacle of which the temple is destroyed in 70. Does that make sense? So the war didn't just destroy the temple in AD 70. It was happening for the years coming up to AD 70. Well, during that time period of 66 to 70, this woman has a child. And the child is described in Josephus as still nursing. It's a very young child. And the famine's so bad that she's speaking to her child and she says, what's best? For both of us continue to live, because the more that I feed you, the more that it drains me of my power, and I'm no longer to provide for you, and if I can't provide for you, you will die. And she says, even if you would by some miracle live, then you would just be a slave to the Roman guards or the Roman army that's coming in. What is best? She says. And she makes a decision. What was best in her mind was she killed her baby and roasted him. And then she cut it in half and ate half of it. And it says that the Roman guards come into her little house because they smelled something cooking. And they go in and they say, don't hide from us the food because the famine is so bad. And she says, oh no, I didn't. I'm not going to hide it from you. She takes off her blanket. It's the other half of her baby. And she says, I've saved half of the sacrifice of my son for you as well. And it said that the Roman guards went out of the house puking, some even passing out, and that the word of this woman spread all across the land because that's how bad the famine was. Were there famines and earthquakes in AD 70? Yes. Yes, emphatically, yes. Verse 8, all these are the beginning of birth pains. He uses birth pains here for two reasons. Number one, it's because while the process is coming to an end, the process of the destruction of the temple was coming to an end, it's not at the end yet. These are just signs that the end is coming. The birth pains, it's a sign. Remember when he's emphasizing the first 35 verses? The destruction of the temple has signs, they're everywhere. The second is this. Birth pains is indicating the birthing of a new creation out of the old one. You see what he's saying? This is just the beginning of birth pains of what's ultimately coming, because what ultimately comes with the destruction of the temple is a new creation, because what is the church called in the epistles? The temple of God. The new creation consists of the entire cosmos being changed in that God does not intersect on earth with a building, it intersects on earth with His people. Everything in creation is different. Birth pains is the beginning of a process in which a new creation comes about. And that's what he hammers on in verse 8. Verse 9. Then you, who's the you? Disciples, will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death. And you will be hated by all nations because of me. In Mark chapter 13 and Luke 21, they actually make this quote-unquote persecution, because notice at the beginning there it says, you'll be handed over to persecution. It makes it more explicit. Mark 13 and Luke 21, they also include being flogged in the synagogues, being put into prison, even standing before governors and kings as witnesses to the gospel. Does that sound familiar? There's a little book after our Gospels, it's called Acts. And Acts is full of what? The disciples, the you, being what? Put into prisons, flogged, standing before governors and rulers, persecuted. Matthew adds, and put to death. See, Mark 13 and Luke 21 don't have that, but if you take both of their descriptions of the persecution, it makes a lot of sense in the light of Acts. In your notes that you'll be getting later, I have a list of all the ways in which the disciples died. And a lot of it happened before 70 AD. Matter of fact, Peter and Paul were killed in the mid-60s during the reign of Nero, right before everything started to explode. How? Paul was beheaded in Rome, and Peter was crucified upside down. So, did they experience persecution and even being put to death before the temple happens as birth pains? Yes. Yes, it happened exactly as he says. Verse 10, at that time many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Hello, read the New Testament. That's what's happening in every letter. Paul is describing what? False teachers that are preying on people. He says to the church of Ephesus, be careful because savage wolves will be wearing sheep clothing among you. Matter of fact, 2 Thessalonians 2, when Paul is talking to the church in Thessalonica, he starts saying that a false prophet's come among you, even sent you a letter supposing to be from me, he says. And they're telling you that the second coming's already happened. And then he starts talking about the man of lawlessness. And guess what the man of lawlessness is talking about? He's basically saying in apocalyptic language, the temple hasn't been destroyed yet, church in Thessalonica. Jesus couldn't have come back. It's not possible. The temple had to be destroyed before anything of a second coming could occur. Because that's what Jesus is presenting in this chapter. Paul would have read this chapter. Maybe. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. That kind of sounds like Revelation. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. Now I want to talk a little bit about verse 14 here. Let me read it and then we'll talk about it. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. People a lot of times will use this verse and they will make this argument. It is the church's responsibility to preach the gospels, because at the moment that we preach the gospel to the last nation that needs to hear it, guess what will happen? The second coming will happen. It's almost like God's like, I want to come back, but if they just haven't told everybody yet. It's almost like we have God handcuffed of when He's allowed to come back. That's crazy for a couple of reasons. Number one, theologically that makes no sense at all. Second, in context here, verse 14, we would have to jump all the way to the end, even though the whole time we've been talking about what? Destruction of the temple. Let's define a couple of these words. Whole world. In Greek, the word is oikomene. Say it with me. Oikomene. Oikomene is not the same word as cosmos in Greek. Cosmos, you've heard me say that before, right? Cosmos refers to what? All of creation, everything. Guess what oikomene refers to? In the first century, oikomene was used to refer to the land region in which an empire would be ruling. Specifically, oikomene is used a lot of the times in Roman literature to refer to the territory that the Roman Empire is reigning in. And they would consider themselves reigning what? The whole world. Oikomene, though, is different than cosmos. He says here that and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the oikomene, the whole empire, as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. This is interesting to me. When the disciples are asking the question about when will the end of the age be, they say the word soon teleia. Say it with me. Soon teleia. What do the disciples say? Soon teleia. The word they use for end is soon teleia. You understand what word they're saying? Soon teleia. Okay? Jesus doesn't use this word in verse 14. He uses the word telos for end. Here's my question. Why would Jesus switch the words? Why would he switch the words? Let me tell you what soon teleia means. Soon teleia. Who said soon teleia? Disciples. Soon teleia means the end of everything. The completion of everything. The final consummation. Absolute end. So when the disciples are asking about the end of the age, they're saying, when will everything be done? And Jesus comes and he says, well, after the gospel goes to the whole empire, the telos will come, but not the soon teleia. See, telos is a word for end that means the end of a process. Or a goal. Not the complete end of all processes, not the complete end of every goal, but the complete end of a process which would relate wonderfully to the temple, which was a process by which God was bringing about the Messiah and being a light to the Gentiles, but it was not the end of everything. He uses telos instead of soon teleia for a reason, because their end is misdefined. And he is redefining what the word end means, because destruction of the temple and his second coming are not the same event. They're different. The destruction of the temple is a telos. But the second coming is a soon teleia. You see what's happening? Verse 14 is not saying once you preach the gospel to the ends of the earth, then the second coming will happen. It's saying once the gospel is spread throughout the Roman Empire, then at that point you know that's a sign that the temple will be destroyed shortly thereafter. And the question is, does the New Testament affirm this? Yes! Paul, in Romans chapter 1, verse 8, says, the faith is being reported all over the world! He says in Colossians 1:16, all over the world this gospel is bearing fruit. And in Colossians 1:23, listen to what he says. This is the gospel that you heard, and that has been... And that has been proclaimed, listen to this, to every creature under heaven. You see, according to Paul's perspective, the gospel had tidal waved, tsunamied the empire. to the point where he can say that the gospel has been preached to every creature under heaven. Paul would look at 14 and says, this has happened in my lifetime, therefore that means for Paul, the temple could be destroyed at any moment. See what's happening. Verse 14 in context makes no sense to jump to the second coming, especially when you look at what Jesus is actually saying, which is clouded by the NIV. Just being flat out honest, it's clouded. But whenever you put it in context, you can see what Jesus taught. He's not jumping 2,000 plus years ahead. He's still talking about the destruction of the temple. Verse 15. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. The abomination of desolation. This is where Luke 21 helps us so much. Luke 21, verse 20, says this. The abomination of desolation equals Jerusalem being surrounded by armies. He says Jerusalem will be being surrounded by armies is a sign that the desolation has come upon us. The abomination of desolation equals what? Jerusalem being surrounded by armies. And this is in a location of Judea, and you see that because it says in verse 16, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Where are we? Jerusalem. Mark 13, Luke 21, and Matthew 24 all say, we are in Jerusalem. Now let's keep reading. Verse 17. When the abomination of desolation comes, let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. The point of that, those two images is this. Get out now. Don't wait around. It is urgent that you go. Don't go back into the fire to try to grab your belongings. Get out of the fire. You see what he's saying? As soon as you see the abomination of desolation, which would be weird if that was the destruction of the temple, as soon as you see the abomination of desolation, get out, because it's about to get bad. He keeps going. Verse 19, how dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath. Now let's break some of those down. Pregnant women and nursing mothers. This is not just emphasizing urgency, but swiftness in your flight. And frankly, pregnant mothers and nursing mothers would not be as swift as non-pregnant mothers or non-nursing mothers, right? Same thing in the winter. Don't think cold. Think of a lot of stinking rain in their particular region. The rains during the winter months would be so bad that travel is virtually impossible. So he says, pray that it will not be that pregnant mothers and nursing mothers will have to go through this because they're going to have to get out quick. Pray that it won't be in winter because they're going to have to get out quick. Pray that it will not be on the Sabbath. Why? Because if Christians start just bailing out on Jerusalem, they'll not only be a target for the Romans, but for who else? The keepers of the Sabbath. The Jews. Your flight has to be urgent and quick. So if these obstacles are in the way, guess what? It's going to be pretty hard. Now this is something that's interesting to me. A couple things. First of all, it's this. If he says that after the abomination of desolation appears, get out of Dodge, then guess what the abomination of desolation cannot be? The destruction of the temple. Right? The temple's destroyed, then get out? No. He doesn't want you in there when the temple's being destroyed. He says, whenever this sign appears, flee as quick as you can because it's about all to go down. Get out. The second question I have is this. Did this happen? The answer emphatically is yes. In Josephus. Josephus, I've used him already a couple times. He is a historian, Jewish/Roman historian in the first century. And he was alive during these events. Josephus describes this guy by the name of Cestius Gallus. He is a Roman general, and the Roman general Cestius Gallus, in AD 66, notice where we're at, 4 years before the temple be destroyed. AD 66, Cestius Gallus, he's fighting all these Jewish revolts that are going on, because really, the revolt started in 66, and they lasted for another 5 years or so. He's fighting all these Jewish revolts, and finally gets ticked off, and he's like, you know what, I'm going for the temple. So he takes his army and they go to the northeast corner of the city of Jerusalem. And they just demolish it. They go right in and then they come up. It says he leads his army to the retaining wall of the temple in Jerusalem. At this point, he has his standards or his placards that are raised up really high to show not only that they are in war, but who it is that's coming to fight them. The graven images of the eagle and lightning on their placards standing at the temple wall. He says that his armies start to light fires to burn down the wall. And all of a sudden, Cestius Gallus calls it off. There's really no rhyme or reason. Matter of fact, Josephus even says, he says, had Cestius Gallus at that particular moment decided to force his way through the walls, he would have captured the city forthwith and the war would have been over. Some reason, Cestius Gallus retreats. And he actually has to, him and his army have to fight their way back down to Caesarea. This is what's cool. This happened, according to Josephus, on the eighth day of Dios in AD 66, which would be October 16th, AD 66. Okay? This is 4 to 6 weeks before the winter. Did you catch that? Jesus says, pray this doesn't happen in winter, because, man, I'm telling you, if it goes down in winter, you're in trouble. This is 4 to 6 weeks before winter. And guess what? October 16th, AD 66 is a Sabbath. If they would have bursted through then, the Christians would have been up a creek. I am suggesting that this is the abomination of desolation and that Jesus held to his promise of pray that this doesn't happen and I will deliver. This event happened on a Sabbath, 4 to 6 weeks before the winter, and Jesus says, guess what? I won't let the temple be destroyed now because I want my Christians to get out. And the question now is, did they? Did they get out? Josephus writes this, after the catastrophe of Cestius, many distinguished Jews abandoned the city as swimmers desert a sinking ship. And Eusebius tells us that Christians fled from Jerusalem and they went to a city called Pella. Yes! The Christians saw the sign and they bailed. Why? Because Matthew 24 told them to do so when they saw the abomination of desolation. This is not something in the future. This happened in AD 70. He's saying, you disciples, get out. And they did. Keep going, verse 21. For then there will be a great distress unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. Josephus actually echoes that. As a matter of fact, let me read two things for you. Chrysostom, one of the early church fathers, says this, do not let anyone suppose that Jesus is merely speaking in hyperbole, he's talking about Matthew 24. All you need to do is study the writings of Josephus, this church father says, to learn the truth of these predictions. No one who knows the fact of history can say that Christian believers has exaggerated this tragic history or been any part of trying to see the Christ's words were fulfilled. He says, was it that bad? You're darn right it was. Josephus says, I shall therefore speak from my mind here once briefly, that neither did any other city ever suffer such miseries. He even describes thousands and thousands, so much so of people dying, so much so he said that there were actual rivers of blood flowing in the city of Jerusalem. Remember that description of the woman that was eating her baby? That happened at the same time. Is Jesus being hyperbolic? Possibly, but guess what? It was really that bad. Verse 22, if those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, at what time? At that time. Who's the you? Disciples. We're still in AD 70. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. See, I have told you ahead of time. Who is the you?
Disciples.
I, Jesus says, have told you, disciples who are asking me a question about the destruction of the temple, ahead of time. Why? So that you won't be deceived and caught up in this muck and mire. So if anyone tells you, there he is out in the desert, do not go out there. Or, here he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. Who is he talking to? Disciples. Now we're going to be reading some verses that people are going to say, wait a minute, I've even seen posters of this talking about the second coming. Here's my question. In context, where are we? In Jerusalem, AD 70, exactly. Now, this next verse is going to be one that you're not going to like if I'm going to be talking about 80-70. I'm just letting you know that right now. But you'll see in context, this verse is talking about 80-70. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Two big problems there. Number one, shame. That's a verse that holds near and dear to my heart. I even have posters of it that says lightning comes from the east and west. The word lightning is interesting. In the Old Testament, the word lightning is used a lot of times for God's judgments on evil nations. And it's used to describe theophanies, or appearances, the presence of God Himself, like on Mount Sinai. It was riddled with lightning. God coming on earth to show His magnificence is usually attached to lightning. But in their culture, one of the key symbols out of two for the Roman Empire was eagles and lightning. They actually described the entire imperial system in the symbol of lightning. And they show that it does go from east to west. Why? Because that's how much they reign, Rome says. We reign everything from the east and the west. Just like lightning, so is our reign. Rome says we are sovereign through lightning. And it's interesting to me that Jesus is coming in judgment and it's used in the symbolic language of lightning. What is He saying politically? I am in control, not Rome. When I come, guess what? It's because I am the king of the world. I am the emperor of emperors, not those phonies. Okay? The question next will come up to me. Well, it says coming of the Son of Man. Coming, Shane. Is that not clear enough? This is the second coming? Well, here's the problem. The word coming in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, is used in two different contexts. Number one, the final coming, where everything's done. Everything. That is true. But there's another way the word coming is used, to describe God coming to judge a nation. There was a coming on Babylon. Babylon itself was used as a coming of God on the nation of Israel to send them into exile. There was a coming in Isaiah on the nation of Egypt. There was a coming on the Medo-Persians, a coming on the Greeks, but guess what? That didn't end everything. It was God coming in judgment. How do you know then which is which? Context. If in context everything's talking about the consummation of everything, guess what? The word coming means second coming. But if in context everything is talking about a judgment in space and time, guess what the word coming means? Judgment in space and time on a nation. In context, what would this verse 27 be pointing to? Because the verse 26 verse has been talking about what? Destruction of the temple. It'd be weird that all of a sudden he jumped 2,000 years ahead, because in a minute he's going to come right back to 80-70. You see what I'm saying? Let's keep going. Wherever there is a carcass, there will be vultures. Oh, there are vultures will gather. This is what I'm saying. The word carcass is actually the word corpse. And this is used in the Old Testament to describe wicked nations and sometimes even to describe the nation of Israel itself. Remember in chapter 23, somebody was called a walking corpse? Who was that? Pharisees. The Jewish elite. You are whitewashed tombs. You decorate your tombs so wonderfully, but guess what? You're still dead on the inside. You are walking dead. You're a corpse, Jesus says. And right here, don't look at the word carcass. It's the word corpse. Wherever there is a corpse, there the vultures will gather. I don't know why they put the word vultures there. With all that's in me, I have no idea why they put the vultures there. You know what that word is? Eagles. It's weird they put vultures there because eagles are not scavengers like a vulture is. But this word never, in any other context, in the Bible or in classical Greek literature, it is never translated vultures except for here. It's always eagles. And what's one of the other key signs of the Roman Empire? Not just lightning, but eagles. You see what's surrounding chapter 27. Or verse 27, for as lightning comes from the east and west, so there also the eagles will gather with the corpse. The word gather together doesn't just mean a location, it also means those that are gathering together share the same fate. You see what he's saying? What he's saying is this. When the temple is destroyed, everyone will look and say, look how sovereign Rome is. Guess what? I'm telling you ahead of time so that you know it's not Rome that's doing this. It is not Rome that's doing this. It's me. I am the one in control, not Rome. Matter of fact, Rome, that eagle, will share the same fate as the corpse. They're gathered together. And what's their fate? destruction at the coming of the Son of Man. Because I will not let Rome get the credit for what I am doing to my own people or the people that have rejected me. You see what he's saying? Why is it important to bring up Rome in this context? Because people will look at the destruction of the temple and say, wow, look how powerful Rome is. And Jesus is saying, don't miss it. It's me. That's why I'm telling you ahead of time. Matter of fact, 40 years ahead of time. So that you know when it happens, it's me, not Rome. Let's keep going. Verse 29. Immediately after the stress of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. See, Shane, this is clearly, clearly second coming. I mean, how in the world can you say that the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, heavenly bodies will be shaken? How is that not the destruction of everything? What genre are we in? Apocalyptic slash prophetic, correct? You know what's weird is that this exact same concept, the sun being darkened, the moon even being turned to blood red, the stars falling, is quoted somewhere else in our New Testament, and it's Acts chapter 2. What's significant about that chapter? Acts chapter 2? Pentecost. Peter gets up, and these Jewish leaders saying, oh, these guys are drunk. They're speaking in all these weird languages. And Peter gets up, and he's like, no, we're not drunk. He's like, this, what we're doing here, this is that. And what is the that he points to? Joel chapter 2, which starts off in the last days. And then it starts talking about, you know, the daughters will prophesy and the God's Spirit will descend. And during that discussion in chapter 2, he says, the sun will be darkened. The moon will be turned to blood red. The stars will fall. Is that literally occurring in Pentecost? Yes and no. The sun really didn't turn black, but guess what? What was happening at Pentecost was so cataclysmic that the old creation was passing and a new one was emerging. You see what's happening? That the events in Pentecost and in AD 70 are so cataclysmic that the world will never be the same again. Not to mention the fact that this language, always in prophetic literature, is talking about political upheavals. Because Rome defined itself as the movers of the sun and the moon and the stars, as a matter of fact. Augustus was considered, at his birth, the calendar was rewritten to start from the birth of Augustus. Because they said, it is at this point that all of creation came into being when Augustus Caesar was born. So, if God does something and it shakes the heavenly bodies, the emperors thought they were the heavenly bodies. They controlled everything. Matter of fact, even on coins, you have a coin of Domitian's son who dies, and they call him Son of God on the coin. He's sitting on the whole earth, and he's holding seven stars. What is that saying? He controls the cosmos. He controls the way things move. If Jesus' events, his coming, shatters the cosmos, what is that saying about the political establishment that's currently there? It's gone. See what's happening? It's kind of like him saying, you know that corpse that's oppressing you people? And you know that stinking eagle that's oppressing you people? I'm still in charge. Because baby, when I come in judgment on this particular establishment, everything's different. A new creation is born. Now this is important also because in a minute, Jesus is going to say, all these things will happen in this generation. That's going to happen in like three verses. Here's my question. Then this generation, if this is talking about the second coming, Jesus is flat out wrong. Because this generation that he's talking to didn't see the second coming, did they? You see what's building here? These passages look like second coming if you rip them out of context. But if you keep them in context, guess what? We've never stopped talking about the destruction of the temple. Ever. You see what's happening? Let's keep going because this becomes even more powerful. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. Oh, that's cool. The word sign there is the word for a standard. The same standards that the Romans would have been going into battle and they would have had their signs like an eagle and lightning on them. That's the same word that's used here. For the standard of Christ will be in the air, which is why a lot of early church historians say that this verse is saying that it is the cross that appears in the sky at the destruction of the temple of Jerusalem. And all the nations on the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Do you see the cataclysmic reality of the destruction of the temple? It affects everything. No one on the earth will miss the fact that this cataclysmic event has happened. It's not possible to miss it. Verse 31, and he will send his angels. I'm sorry, who will send his angels? Whose angels are it traditionally in the Bible? Who is the controller of angels? God. Who is sending them here? Jesus. That's a weird thing to say, unless he's God. He will send his angels with a loud trumpet call. Trumpet throughout the Bible is a symbol of what? War. It's a battle instrument. It's something that is always involved not only before wars, but after wars and during wars. In other words, Jesus is saying, I am declaring war on the corpse and on the eagle. Don't let anybody miss it. And he ends up the phrase saying, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. He is saying, no one's gonna miss what this event is saying. Because I am in control. Context has never changed. How do I know that? Well, this parable, verses 32 through 35, summarizes everything we've just said. Let's read the parable. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. And that would have been something they would have been very familiar with. As soon as the twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, when you see all these things, you see what things? All the things he's just talked about. The sun being darkened, the moon, the star, all of these cataclysmic events.
Talking about the apostles.
He's talking to the disciples, exactly. You see these things. The you has not changed to some future generation. When you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. Why does he use the fig tree? Two reasons. Number one, the fig tree blossoming, the fig tree's blossom was considered, a lot of the time considered, as something that was inevitable. Let me read this to you. This is a document from the first century, or the second century. Jesus uses the fig tree rather than another kind of tree as an illustration for the onset of summer because it commonly happens that after other trees have begun to bloom, a cold snap forces them back into hibernation. Did you hear that? But then he says this, since the fig tree blooms later than almost all the other trees, however, its fruitfulness is virtually never interrupted by the cold. You see what he's saying? He's saying, like the fig tree, this is going to happen. And when you see the signs, you know it's inevitable. This is going to happen. The same way when a fig tree starts to bloom, there's not going to be a cold that's going to snap it back. It's going to bloom. And you know summer's coming. And then there's a second reason why he uses the fig tree. Because it's a sign they would clearly see. They wouldn't miss it. They know when a fig tree is coming. They have no question that a fig tree is coming because that is something that was universally, not universally, but commonly known. When a fig tree starts to bloom, guess what's coming? Summer. It's a clear sign, which is weird if he's talking about the second coming because what's he going to say in three verses? No one knows about the day or the hour, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Doesn't sound so clear. You see his distinction. The destruction of the temple is clear. The second coming, not so clear. Why? Because there's not signs for the second coming. Keep going. I tell you the truth. This generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. I'm sorry, what'd you say? This generation is interpreted, can be interpreted in three ways. Number one, he's talking about a future generation. Guess what? The problem is, context doesn't support that. The words this generation, never in the history of the Bible, this generation, is never referring to a future generation. Guess what generation it's referring to? This one. The one he's talking to. And guess how long a generation, usually scholars have said a generation consists of? How many years? 40. Which is pretty weird. Because Jesus is speaking around 30-ish. And when's the temple destroyed?
70.
About 40 years away. This generation will not pass until these things come to be. He's talking about the temple. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. I'm going to end on this because this is interesting to me. The temple was considered in Jewish literature to be not only what is called in Jubilees 8:19 and 1 Enoch 26:1, the navel of the earth, the very center of the earth, but its actual structure was considered by the Jews and the scholars that have studied this to be structured in a way that represents the entire cosmos. They called the inner sanctuary, the sanctuary where God lived, the heavenlies, the heavenly realm. They called the inner court where the Jews would go the earth. And they called the outer court the sea where the Gentiles would be. But the point is that the structure of the temple itself was made in a way that it is representative of the entire cosmos. As a matter of fact, when Herod's rebuilding the temple, he is fought tooth and nail by the Jews of changing the structure of the temple because it would change a lot of theology that they have wrapped up in the temple. That heaven and earth is summed up in this temple. Which is interesting to me because a rabbi in the Babylonian Talmud says this. He says, Bezalel knew the letters by which heaven and earth were created. Guess what he's talking about there when he says heaven and earth created? The temple. He's talking about the temple here. And this is what I think is fascinating. When Jesus says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words never will pass away, he's ending the conversation the same way he started it, predicting the destruction of the temple. Heaven and earth passing away, which kind of sounds like a new creation. You see what's happening here? Jesus says, oh, don't get me wrong. This temple's going. But guess what? My words describing it's going, they're not going anywhere. They will prove to be legitimate. Why is it significant the temple's destroyed? Well, in Jesus' day, this would have been a ridiculous statement. To look at this magnificent structure of which the disciples have to remind Jesus of how beautiful the buildings are, and to say this is going to be destroyed in 40 years is like me saying America's going to be wiped off the map in 40 years. You see how idiotic that sounds? And what Jesus is saying is, but the will of God will accomplish anything. Period. The significance of the temple being destroyed is saying the old order's done. There is a new creation that is founded in the cross, that is founded in an empty tomb, and that comes to fruition when this structure is eliminated. Because heaven and earth no longer intersect in a building, they intersect in people with the Holy Spirit. That changes all of creation, because it is a new creation, and as a matter of fact, Paul calls the church, in 2 Corinthians 5:17 and in Galatians 6:15, a new creation. The new creation was inaugurated in Christ's first coming that comes to fruition in the destruction of the temple, of which you are a part of. And in 3 weeks, we'll talk about how being a part of that leads to the final new heavens and new earth coming in the second coming. Your homework for next week. I want you to examine five verses. Matthew chapter 30, or chapter 24, 36 through 40, 41. I want you to write down as many observations as you can about it. Matthew chapter 24, 36 through 41. 36 through 41. Write down as many observations as you can. Who is talking? Who's the audience? What are the metaphors? Everything. And then I want you to write down as many questions that you can about the text. And hopefully next week, whenever we start talking about Matthew chapter 24, 36 through 41, your questions will be answered. Next week, though, will be dedicated to the rapture. Because you will read in Matthew 24, 36 through 41, it is one of the biggest rapture texts that's out there. Until then, you're dismissed. God bless. If you have any questions, I'll be up here for a couple minutes.